Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to, and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting, or do I wait for the next one, like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia, and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism. And he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
And I kind of just stopped all the struggle. I closed my eyes and took a couple of breaths and, you know, relaxed, thinking, okay, yeah, we'll just kind of slip off here. I guess if I'm going to die, I'm going to do it peacefully.
Welcome to What Was That Like? I'm your host, Scott Johnson. This is the show where we talk to regular people, people just like you or just like me, who have found themselves in an extremely unusual situation. We'll hear their stories and get inside their head, because we all want to know, what was that like? More information about each episode at whatwasthatlike.com. Here we go. Probably most people have been in some type of car accident at some point in their life. I've been in more than one myself, none of them serious or even involved injuries. These things are common. Human drivers make mistakes, and cars just run into each other sometimes. But the crash we're talking about today was not a simple fender bender. Luke and five of his friends were just having a fun 4th of July vacation In fact, this episode is being released on July 5, 2019, the 5-year anniversary of the day of the accident. Everyone in the car that day was seriously injured. Two of them did not survive. My hope with this episode is that as you hear Luke tell the story of what happened that day, it's going to serve as a reminder to drive safely and use good judgment. Your passengers are depending on you to do that. What happened to these six young men could easily happen to any of us. All it takes is a brief lapse in judgment or focus. As a note, going forward, I'm probably not going to do any more stories about auto accidents. I do get submissions pretty regularly from people with a car crash story, but if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know I have a pretty high standard on what I consider to be an unusual story. Most car crashes aren't unusual or extreme enough to get on the show. Today's story is the exception. And if you'd like to join some other listeners who are supporting the show, you can do that through my Patreon at whatwasthatlike.com/support. Hang around after today's story with Luke, and I'll have some information about different Patreon reward levels that are now in place, and the podcast has its own subreddit and the private Facebook group. All kinds of stuff's going on, and I'll tell you all about that at the end of today's show. My goal is to continue to put out episodes that are worth supporting, and for your support, I thank you. And now, here's my conversation with Luke. Do you know if anyone was wearing a seatbelt that day?
Well, I know I was wearing mine, and that's part of the reason why I'm here to tell you this. There were six of us in a car that was designed for five people, so automatically, one guy's not wearing his seatbelt.
Yep, that's unfortunate, and obviously it's important. Not that it may or may not have saved lives, but it certainly is usually a good idea. Well, let's talk about you. This was what happened that day. You had six, you and five of your friends traveling to a lake house. Can you kind of tell us what was the plan for that day or for that weekend?
So we go back about a week before this is 4th of July weekend, 2014. My friend Marcus and I, we are just huge fireworks fanatics. Anything that goes boom, we've loved it. Ever since I was little, I love shooting off fireworks, and he's been the same way. He just takes it another level higher than me. He figured out that if you buy wholesale, you know, instead of going to the tents, you buy from the people that sell to the tents, you can stretch your money and buy all sorts of crazy fireworks. So he somehow hooked up with his distributor. Me and four or five people, we threw in a couple $100 and, you know, pack this Ford Explorer full of fireworks and drive it back. He starts researching every piece we've got. He makes this like schematic, like he's putting together some sort of circuit or something. And he's got everything figured out with different lengths of fuses at different burn rates. So we're going to go and have this spectacular fireworks display at his lake house at Truman Lake. So we've got all this worked out. And at this point, I've kind of got a rough idea who's going. I knew it was going to be Marcus, myself, Daniel was going, and Eddie, my buddy, who I've known for about 20 years. Well, the day of the 3rd of July comes, I end up having to work late that night. So I get off work at about 10 o'clock, and I head on over to Marcus's house, which is only about a half mile from where I worked. And I had all my bags packed. I was ready to go. This was going to be a fun weekend. I've been down to this lake house of theirs probably four or five times in the last 3 or 4 years. It was actually the first road trip I took after I got my driver's license was down to that lake house. And pull up, and there's another one of my friends who I hadn't seen in quite a while, my buddy Neil from high school. He left high school, joined the Army. He'd been away for a while. And turns out he's also kind of a bit of a pyro and a fireworks fanatic. So, all right, we've got the team together. We're going to have a good time. So, pack his car full of fireworks. Another one of my friends, Mary, she's coming with us just for, we're going to supposed to be down there for 3 or 4 days. She was just going to be down there for about a day and a half, 2 days. She had some family up in Minnesota that she was going to be visiting. So we take these two cars down. We leave Kansas City. We leave it at probably close to midnight, and we're heading down to Truman Lake in Missouri. And obviously the middle of Missouri in July, it's fireworks stands about every 20 miles. So we keep stopping and just buying more stuff and piling it in both cars.
So how far away was the lake house? What was the distance of this trip?
So we live just south of Kansas City and on the Kansas side. And Truman Lake is about an hour, hour and a half from us, probably closer to an hour. Now, with all the stops that we took, it took us closer to maybe 2.5-3 hours to get down there. We get down, lake house, obviously, it's at least 3 a.m, and we're all just super jazzed to be down there. I've got, you know, a week off work. Everyone else is going to be celebrating the holiday. We're all stoked. Most of Marcus's family was down at the lake house, too, and it's a fairly small house. I mean, it was only 2 floors, I think maybe 2 bedrooms and 1.5 bathrooms. So we had, you know, made the decision ahead of time. We were just going to, you know, pitch tents on the front lawn and camp. We don't mind sleeping on the ground. That we set up our camp. The next day on the 4th of July, we obviously play around with some of the smaller fireworks. And we start setting up this big old display. I mean, it took Marcus maybe 2 or 3 hours to get everything wired together. And that time, this would have been, you know, later in the afternoon, 3 or 4, one of Marcus's friends, who's good friends with his little brother, his name is Will, he shows up. So Will shows up with Marcus's little brother, and they're going to be, you know, spending some time there for the weekend too. So we finish getting everything set up. I meet Will, he's a real great guy, got along well with him. We ended up having some cigars that night after the fireworks display. So we set off this display. He had it all timed out, wired together perfectly. Probably, you know, lasted a good 15 to 20 minutes. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
That's pretty amazing for an amateur setup.
Someone who's, you know, never done anything like that. He just, when Marcus gets something into his head, he doesn't half-ass it. He whole-asses it. It's all him.
Marcus is your best friend.
Yeah, he's I've known him since I met him in 7th grade in a industrial tech class, and we both had an interest in model rocketry, and that's kind of how our friendship just kind of blossomed over the years. His house was always the hangout house.
And it's his family that owned the lake house.
Yeah, it belonged to his grandparents. And they never really used it that much. We would go down there periodically just for weekends and spring breaks, just because nice to get away from the city, and you're next to Truman Lake, which is, and their part is absolutely beautiful. It's ringed by these, you know, 150, 100 foot tall bluffs that we would hike up and down, and just gorgeous. So get our display done and having the time of our life. We see Mary off. She drives back to Kansas City so she can head on up to Minnesota the next day. You know, for a girl drives, you know, an hour and a half home at midnight, only to leave at 8 o'clock the next day to drive, you know, 8.5 hours north. You know, the next day we wake up and we're like, well, we've got a couple more days here. Let's do it again. So we're trying to figure out what we want to do for the rest of the day. And a couple of the guys with us, Marcus and Daniel, they were both Boy Scouts, and we're down near a Boy Scout camp that a lot of the Midwesterners go to. I think it's called Bartle. And near this Boy Scout camp is this tiny little Missouri town called Iconium. And in Iconium, there's a general store, a convenience store, so to speak, a Ma and Pa type joint that all the scouts kind of frequent, because, you know, the scout camp, there's, you know, none of the amenities of home, no air conditioning, you know, like cold pop or anything like that. So all the scouts kind of flock here. So it's a good memory for a lot of these people. At this store in Iconium, they sell this soda that's, I guess it's kind of hard to find. It's peach flavored knee high. And I've got one of my cans here with me today that I've saved from way back when. And it's peach flavored soda. There's really nothing special about it other than it's pretty tasty. And you go down to the store there in Iconium, there's a little restaurant attached, and you get burgers. And we got floats made with this peach knee high, peach soda and soft serve ice cream. Sounds kind of weird, but it's quite the combo, especially on, you know, an 85 degree day. So they talk us into going down to Iconium, which was, I don't know, maybe a 30 minute drive from where we were at. And of course, you know, none of us had the foresight to use our GPS, so we were destined to get lost. But so we all pile back into his Explorer, and Marcus says, "Hey, Will, I mean, backtrack a little bit. Will's a couple years younger than us, and he's a good friend of Marcus's younger brother. So Marcus's younger brother didn't want to come with us, but Marcus asked Will. Will said, sure. So six of us, we hop in to his Ford, and we drive on down the road, and there's really not a whole lot in this part of Missouri. Obviously, you've got Truman Lake and Lake of the Ozarks, which are, you know, your recreational areas, but once you get about 20 miles from them, it's pretty barren again.
As you guys took off on this trip, can you tell us who was where in the car? Where were you all sitting?
So Marcus was driving. It was his car, 2001 Ford Explorer. We called it the Exploder because the engine was kind of misfiring and it kind of growled instead of, you know, hummed like a normal engine would. Will was sitting in the front seat. He was the tallest, had the longest leg, so we gave him the most leg room. I mean, I'm 6'1", and he was about a head taller than me, so that was a pretty obvious decision. I was sitting in the back seat behind the driver. Daniel was to my right, so he was the middle back seat. He was kind of the smallest guy in our group, so he could kind of squeeze between me and Neil, who was sitting in the back passenger seat. And then, in our infinite wisdom, we decided Eddie could ride in the trunk of the Ford. There was a lot of room back there, and figured what's the worst that could happen. We're just going, you know, 30 minutes down the road. And one of the things that kind of, the little things that sticks with me is I remember going into the tent and grabbing my wallet and my phone and stuff out of my backpack and looking down. I saw my pocket knife sitting on top, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to need that. We're only going to be gone about an hour. So we all pile into his Ford, and we're heading on out towards Iconium. Of course, we get lost along the way. So like 20, 30-minute drive ends up taking like an hour. And it's probably, I don't know, 11 a.m. by the time we get there. So we pile out. We all head on in. Marcus and Daniel, they're kind of reminiscing about their scouting days down there and talking to the owner who they have, you know, met previously from their time at scout camp. We're all just kind of milling around the store. We head outside to the little restaurant attached. We have a real nice lunch of burgers, fries, and these wonderful peach knee-high floats that I still adore to this day. And then we decide to head back. We have the right directions this time. It's a much shorter trip. And I remember we're going down the highway, and I see a tow truck, like a wrecker, a flatbed that had a car that had obviously been in an accident on the back. And you could see that the windshield was bowed out from the inside, like something had hit it from the inside and pushed it out. And I just remember saying, you see, guys, that's why you need to wear a seatbelt. That's what happens at speed. Something along that lines. I, at the time, was taking classes in college in the criminal justice field. And I had a class about like, you know, accident reconstruction, that sort of thing. So kind of like, oh, yeah, it's practical application of what I'm learning in college. On the way back, we stopped in Clinton, Missouri, which is another one of the larger towns down there. And 5th of July, there's firework stands everywhere. So we top off the gas tank in the Explorer, and we start hitting up these firework stands. And of course, you know, it's the day after, so everyone's got their stuff discount. They all want to unload it all and go home. So everything's 40, 50, 60% off. And then, you know, my buddy Neil, he's military, so he's like, you have a military discount. So we start getting everything even cheaper and cheaper. So we start loading this truck full of fireworks again. And I mean loading it full. So we're all packed in there. Oh, and I should also mention, while at Iconium, you know, I fell in love with this peach knee-high soda. I bought, I think, 3 or 4 12-packs. Everyone else had bought 2 or 3. So we had, you know, these 10, 12-packs of soda crammed into this car along with all of our fireworks and 6 full-size grown men. So we pull on out of Clinton. It's probably 1:45, 1:50 in the afternoon. Beautiful day. It was overcast sky, maybe 80 degrees. You know, we're planning to do fireworks show round 2. We were all psyched up and amped up, heading on back. So we pull off of this little 2-lane highway onto the dirt road that we take back to the little neighborhood where the lake house is in. The speed limit there is probably 30 miles an hour. And it's a fairly skinny, it's unpaved, it's gravel road. And there are some short but steep hills. And this little road is maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles long before it gets to the neighborhood, with woods on pretty much either side. So Marcus, he's a bit of an adrenaline junkie. We all sort of are at heart, but he's more so than any of us. Hey, we take off down this road. Speed limit's probably 20, 25 miles an hour. And we're just flying down this thing. He's having a good time up front. Everyone else is whooping and hollering. I'm kind of, you know, a bit uneasy about it. So we're tearing down the road. He's getting air on some of these hills. I remember hearing Daniel say, "It's a beautiful day to die, gentlemen." And we're just screaming down the road. I think we hit, I think the report said 79 miles an hour was their recorded speed. So a very good clip. And we just fly right over this hill. And in my mind, I'm thinking, "Oh, please God, don't let there be a car on the other side of that hill. I don't want to, you know, slam into someone else." So I kind of get that feeling in the pit of my stomach, like when you're in a roller coaster, you kind of feel everything go up. And I don't know why, I just kind of, I shut my eyes and I felt like a turtle kind of pulled into my shell. I kind of pulled myself tight and you could feel the car leave the ground. I heard the engine just rev incredibly fast. You know, the wheels aren't on the ground, so they're just freely spinning now. And everything's happening over the course of maybe 5 or 6 seconds, but you know, like they say, it feels like it was a lot longer. It kind of felt like an eternity between the sound of that engine revving and the loudest bang I've ever heard in my entire life. So we leave the road, and off to the left, we somehow flew right into the woods. We caught a tree that was maybe 12, 18 inches in diameter, a fairly good-sized tree. We caught it about 4 feet off the ground, snapped it in two. And that was the bang I heard. So I've got my eyes shut tight. There's just a massive bang. The world exploded around me. I slam forward against my seatbelt and I pull myself tight, make a little ball, try to protect myself, I guess. And then another bang, and then three or four more. And I feel like I'm on a roller coaster. I'm just getting flung around, but I've got myself kind of pulled pretty tight, so I'm not moving. I can just feel myself, you know, being pulled around by the force of this car moving around. And then it just stops and it's silence. I can hear the engine knocking its last few death strokes, I guess. I hear some hissing. I feel something spraying on my face. And I can hear, I'm not sure who it was. I think it might have been Neil, kind of softly moaning like he'd been knocked out. And then that's when I opened my eyes. And I saw broken glass, peach knee-high cans. That's what was spraying me in the face. And I saw my hand braced against the roof of the car. And my hand was bloody. And I'm thinking, shit, we are going to get in so much trouble for this. We're going to be dead meat when we get back to that lake house. They are going to be so pissed off at us.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%, so I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/what. was.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great. And I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
And I'm thinking, well, I'm cutting out. Crap, I've got to go to the hospital. My parents are going to be pissed off at me. It's like, I'm really screwed. And then I kind of look around and I realize, wait, we're upside down. The roof is caved in. My head's at a really weird angle from being crunched in. And wait, I can't see anybody else. Kind of gets a little fuzzy here. I mean, I didn't get my head knocked around. I didn't get a head injury or anything like that. I didn't even really think I was hurt besides a cut on my hand. So I start kind of frantically looking around. I look in the front seat. I see Marcus, and I think he must have been knocked out. So I look around. I see Daniel. Daniel's on the roof of the car. I mean, it would be the roof, but now it's the floor since we're upside down. And he's kind of laying on his back in the debris. Because everything that was in this Ford just got thrown around. There's fireworks and soda everywhere. It's all manners of everything. And I can't see Neil to my right. It's all just wreckage. And I can't see Will in the front seat either. It's even more wreckage up there. All I can see is Marcus and Daniel. And then I look to the back, looking for Eddie, since he was riding in the trunk. All I see is wreckage. And the first thing I remember saying is, guys, I think Eddie is dead. I mean, I guess it's kind of thinking out loud. There's really no internal monologue at that point, so to speak. It just becomes an external monologue. So you know, anything that was going through my mind just came right out my mouth at that point. So that's when the realization hits me that you know, this is a lot worse than I initially thought. We're in it pretty deep. Take a look out to my left, and all I see is the ground and trees. I don't know how far we are off the road. To be honest, I didn't know, you know, where we were on the road itself. It all just kind of happened so fast. And I kind of start to take stock of what's going on. I hear Daniel, he's in quite a bit of pain. I didn't really know why at the time. And then Marcus in the front seat, I see he's coughing. So I'm like, well, I mean, at least he's okay. So I'm trying to figure out what to do next. And I'll be honest, I had no idea what to do. I start asking people if they're okay. Can't remember what they said. I would call out to Eddie and Neil, and I would get no response. And I just got more and more worried. People will say and stuff like that, well, there was no time to be afraid. Well, there was plenty of time for me to be afraid. And I'll be the first to admit that I was. So I'm trying to figure out what to do. And I think, well, I need to get out first and foremost. I can start to smell gasoline. If I can get out, I can get help and I can get other people out since I was reasonably sure that I was the least injured person at the time. I didn't know the extent of anyone else's injuries, but I honestly thought I was just fine. I got a little cut on my hand. I'll be okay. I reach down to my right for my seatbelt for the release and can't find it. It's just, you know, a little hole in the seat. Well, the seat had buckled when it got thrown forward. I can't get down there. Get my pocket knife and cut it out. Reach in my pocket. There's no pocket knife. And I'll have that little flashback eureka moment. It's still in my backpack in a tent a mile away. And now is kind of where I'm starting to realize the situation that I'm in. My knees are pretty much in my chest. My legs are squeezed between my seat and Marcus's seat. My head's kind of crammed at a weird angle because all my weight is now on my neck since I'm hanging upside down. So I'm like, okay, I've really got to get out of the seat now. About this time, I can hear Neil kind of coming to my right. I still can't see him, but I can hear him. And I know not even an hour prior in Iconium, Neil had just bought a pocket knife that had one of those seatbelt cutters on it. So I'm like, all right, Neil, I need your knife. Where's your knife? And the response I got from him was, it sounded like when you wake up someone who's asleep and you're kind of talking to them while they're half asleep. You know, he's groggy and slow, and he said, I don't know where it is. Well, I knew Marcus usually has a pocket knife on him as well, so I turned to see him. He's the way his seat ended up is he's almost facing me from the way the car kind of bent his seat. And I ask him for his knife because I know there's usually one in his pocket and probably two or three somewhere in his car. And he didn't know where his was. I don't necessarily remember what he said, but this was kind of the time where I started to realize the extent of his injuries. You know, I'm starting to look around. I'm starting to see a lot, you know, more blood everywhere. And this is kind of when I'm realizing that I might be the only one left that can do something. And this is getting worse by the minute. The kind of the last idea I had was to go for my cell phone. Maybe get a 911 call out. Obviously, I wasn't quite sure where we are, but I figured I could give them a good enough idea where we were for someone to come find us eventually. I didn't know the name of the road. I knew we were off of Route 7 just east of Tightwad, but that was really about it. I go into my right pocket to try to get my phone, and I can't get my fingers more than about a half inch into my pocket. That seatbelt had cinched so tight over my legs that there's no way I could get my hand into there, manipulate my pocket or my shorts to even get a finger in there to get a hand on that phone. And that was kind of my I'm screwed moment. And I didn't know what to do. There was nothing I could do. I was upside down in a truck filled with gasoline and fireworks that I thought could blow up at any minute with five people. And here I am thinking I'm the only one that can do anything, and I've let them all down because I can't do anything. And this would really probably be the first time that I actually thought about the possibility of death. I didn't think anything of it until now. And it came up in a really weird way. I just had an aunt that had passed away, I don't know, maybe half a year prior in a freak accident at home. And I thought about how that kind of screwed my family up, and I mean, how just devastated everyone was from her death. And I thought, great, now they're going to be devastated over another death, and you know, it's the second one in a year. What am I doing? And I kind of just stopped all the struggle. I closed my eyes and took a couple of breaths and, you know, relaxed, thinking, okay, yeah, we'll just kind of slip off here. I guess if I'm going to die, I'm going to do it peacefully. Closed my eyes, took a couple of breaths, and felt the wave of calm come over me, I guess. And then that little voice in the back of my head screams, F that. Snap back into reality, open my eyes, and start going back to work. Still trying, you know, everything I can possibly think of. I'm even thinking, maybe I can grab one of these little itty-bitty pebbles of safety glass off the ground in front of me and try to like gnaw through my seatbelt with that, anything to get me out. And trying to talk to these guys. Marcus, he was in pretty bad shape, and so was Daniel. Daniel was talking about how his legs hurt, saying his legs were broken. So I'm like, trying to keep them calm while at the same time trying to keep myself calm, which was I was failing at for myself anyway. I was getting more and more antsy by the moment. It was every minute I was hanging there in that seat, it was hurting more and more. The seatbelt around my lap was like a boa constrictor, just squeezing the life out of me. My neck was just hurting more and more. And I was losing faith in rescue by the minute, it seemed. So everything's exhausted. I just start yelling. I yelled till I was hoarse. I don't know how long I yelled for, but Daniel joins in. He's yelling. I've kind of got my neck craned out the window. I'm screaming as loud as I can. And then I hear someone running up. And I don't remember what was said to me and what I said to them. I know one of them started yelling to call 911. And he asked me if I was hurt. And I said, no, I'm fine. I just need a knife to get me out of here. Do you have a knife? So he says he thinks he has one. He runs on back up. And at this point, I'm saying, you know, we're good, guys. They're calling 911. We're all going to be good. Don't worry. Something along those lines. Trying to maintain the calm, which I sort of destroyed with my hollering, I guess. And again, you know, things that happen really fast, it seems like time was slowed down. It felt in between the time he left to get the knife to the time he came back was another like 10 minutes. And he must have been the dullest pocket knife because it took him a few good tries to cut the belt on my shoulder and across my lap. Kind of slumped down and to the little space that was right in front of me and realized, well, now how do I get out? Because the window to my left, is the gap is probably less than a foot. And I'm a pretty big guy. There's no way I'm going to be fitting through that. And I guess they started pulling away. All just the wreckage, the boxes of fireworks, the cans of soda and the boxes of soda, everything. They start pulling out and there was one of the trunk windows open. So they grab my arms and shoulders. They pull me and I get about halfway out and he asked me, are you good? I said, yeah, I've got it from here. So I get my hands up on the car and I get ready to push myself out with my legs. And I realize my right leg doesn't work. I'm like, well, that's weird. It doesn't hurt. It's just not working. So he asked me if I was good. I said, well, maybe not. And they grab me. They pull me about 20, 30 feet away and they lean me up against a tree. And I look over to my right and I see Eddie. He's leaning up against another tree and he's just got this massive deer in the headlights look going on, you know. Almost like a zombie-like expression on his face, just kind of blank face with big old eyes. I remember looking over and just in hindsight, it's the goofiest voice to look over and I think, holy shit, it's Eddie. You know, like you walk into a restaurant or something, you see a friend that you weren't expecting there, a buddy that you haven't seen in a while. I'll be honest, I thought he was dead because I looked back into that trunk and all I could see was wreckage. And I say this and he doesn't acknowledge, he doesn't do anything, he just keeps staring straight on ahead. Obviously, there's some red flags come up there, but in my mind, I was just glad to see that he was out. He looked to be in one piece and that he was breathing, so I thought, well, the worst is behind us. In a few weeks when we all get patched up, we'll be sitting around the campfire having cigars and cooking burgers again like we always do. Lean back against the tree. I'm watching this. There's probably 5 or 6 people around the car now. Everyone's got their phone out, and cell phone or service is kind of hard to come by in that area. And someone eventually does get through to 911. And then I think, well, I better call my dad and have him let everyone know I'll be okay because I know my family's going to be worried if they just get a call from the hospital. So I pull my phone out of my pocket, and as soon as I unlock the screen, it powers down. It's out of batteries. So I'm like, well, that's another stroke of bad luck for today, I guess. Then seemed like pretty quickly a state trooper arrived. Big Smokey the Bear hat on. He comes up, he kind of moseyed down the embankment that we were. I realized we were probably about 50-ish feet into the woods, upside down. Kind of took in how badly mangled the car was, but it wasn't registering with me how bad it was at the time. cylinder wasn't firing, I guess. The trooper looks around the car. He does his 360. He's peeking into the windows and comes up and he's like, he asked me if I'm okay. I said, yeah, I think I just have a broken leg. And I said, is it bad? And this, I don't know how to describe the voice really. It was a very soft yet serious voice. He just replies, it's bad. And then he goes back to work calling people on the radio. And this is another one of those times where time just kind of melts together and everything becomes a bit of a blur. The adrenaline's kind of wearing off. Feel myself relaxing a little bit, which is a difficult thing to do after a situation like that. I can kind of hang my shoulders and let the tension go away, I guess. You know, everything's going to be okay. I guess eventually three or four more deputies and troopers show up. All the uniforms are there. And here's about the time we start seeing the paramedics in the fire department. Being out in the sticks like we were, all the fire departments are, they're all volunteers. So the firefighters and paramedics, they've got to leave what they're doing, go to their station after they get the call, get their equipment, and then come to us. So it probably took a good 20 to 30 minutes before the first of the firefighters and paramedics arrived. And I'd see, you know, a group of them coming down the hill. They only go to the car and someone start working then. Someone over to Eddie and started working on him. And I'm just kind of sitting back observing. You know, not really thinking much of anything other than this is going to be a fun one to explain to my parents why my leg is all screwed up because we were driving around being stupid. And then, you know, every few minutes there was a new group that would arrive. They would come down, you know, two of them would come to me and I'd just brush them off. No, don't worry about me. It's just my leg. Go help the others. They're hurt a lot worse than I am. Because I knew at least Marcus was in pretty bad shape. I didn't really know about Will or anybody else. I mean, I knew Daniel had a couple of broken legs. He was next to me on the ground after he had been pulled out. And his feet were pointing in directions they shouldn't be pointing, so to speak. And, you know, this went on three or four times, maybe. A group of paramedics has come up and it's like, don't worry about me. I'll be fine. They need it a lot more than I do. And, you know, back in my mind, I kind of began to notice, well, the three of us are the only ones that are out. It's just, where's everybody else? Why are they still in the car? It's been like an hour. I guess, they were working on extracting them, but first they obviously have to kind of stabilize them and start to treat their injuries in the car. So another group of paramedics shows up. Well, don't worry about me. You know, they're hurt a lot worse than I am. And medic looks at me and says, oh, you're the last one. Well, guess let's go then. Ask me what's wrong and all that stuff. And of course, I'm sitting up and they immediately, you know, get my collar and stuff, get me to a backboard. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a lot of overkill. I feel fine. I just have a tweaked leg. That's all. I didn't even think it was. I thought I must have pulled something. I'll be fine. You know, they get a splint on my leg and they get me and Daniel ready for transport. I can hear them backing the ambulance up the hill to where they were going to load us up. So they take Daniel up first. He's a pretty little guy. And then they get to me. I'm 6'1", 225. I'm not the biggest, but I'm not the littlest. And they've got to carry me strapped to the backboard with all their medical equipment up a fairly short but steep hill and get to the ambulance. So there's like three people on either side of me trying to haul me up this hill, and I'm trying to lighten the mood with the jokes. I'm like, well, I guess this means I should lay off the barbecue, right, guys? Didn't get any laughs, but I tried anyway. Get into the ambulance, and Daniel's in quite a bit of pain. He's in so much pain, he starts yelling in German. He's bilingual, and I didn't really realize that he could do that. But I'm not really feeling anything. My mind is just kind of on, we are going to be in so much trouble. That's, you know, the only thing I can think of is we're screwed. Because now, you know, not only is his car destroyed, but we're hurt, and I'm going to have to pay for an ambulance bill now. And I know those aren't cheap. So, and the ambulance, where another paramedic is talking to me, because I'm in the right state of mind. Didn't get my head banged around. They hadn't pushed any medication to me yet, so I was talking to him just like I'm talking to you now. And he mentions something about a helicopter. What do you mean? He's like, well, we're going to have to fly you guys out. I'm thinking, oh, that's going to be expensive. Then he says, well, you really don't have a choice in it now. I'm like, well, I guess you're right. After a few minutes, they started an IV on me and Daniel. They pushed some pain meds into Daniel, and I told him I didn't need anything. I couldn't feel my leg. That was the only thing that I thought was wrong with me. So I said, I'm fine. And they start driving us down the road back to the highway Route 7, and they take us to this little town of Tightwad, Missouri. About the only thing there is a fire station, a bank, and a convenience store. And on the previous trips to the lake, we always loved stopping in Tightwad. Just, who names a town Tightwad? It's funny. I mean, I've got a Tightwad bank hat somewhere. I've got I would save my receipts from a Tightwad convenience store. We've got pictures in front of the Tightwad sign.
This episode is sponsored by Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code what before checkout for 50% off your first week. When Jeannie and I go out to eat at some local restaurant, one of the things I love to try is a curry dish. I just love it when a chef can get that perfect balance of spices. It's one of my favorite meals. But even better is to have an amazing curry meal without having to go out, like the one I had recently. It was cauliflower and chickpea coconut curry with steamed jasmine rice. And even though it was created by a professional local chef here in Florida, we enjoyed that meal right here at home, thanks to Cook Unity. And you know what else I love? All the prep and cooking is done for me ahead of time. So all I do is just choose the one I want, and 2 minutes later, I'm enjoying a tasty hot meal. It feels like I'm one of those wealthy podcasters with a chef on staff right here at home. Cook Unity meals arrive fresh. They've never been frozen. All of their packaging is earth-friendly, and it's cheaper than other delivery options. Oh, and you have to try that coconut curry.
Experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code WHAT or going to cookunity.com/what.
We drive on out and they pull us into this field by the bank, and they open up the back doors on the ambulance, and I can see, feel, and hear the helicopters. I think there were two or three of them that were on the ground, rotor still running. And then I hear a familiar voice. It was Marcus's mom. And she was at the back of the ambulance asking, what happened? So I kind of briefly explain, we were in a car wreck. I'm not sure how everyone else is. She was asking about the other boys. She was like, she was the mother of our group. A lot of us had hung out at that house for years. And just the biggest sweetheart. Cares deeply about all of us. She's just a wonderful person. And I kind of briefly explain what's going on. And she had no idea. They were shopping in Clinton that day. They were getting groceries at Walmart. And when they came back, the road was blocked off. And she had somehow figured out that it's her son's car that was in the accident. And I asked her, hey, can you call my dad or let him know I'm okay? She's like, what's his phone number? So I start shouting off the number. I messed it up, and I probably gave her like three different numbers, none of which I'm sure were the right one. But the paramedics and the police kind of usher her to the side, I guess. And I get moved into a helicopter. First time in a helicopter. Not a bad ride. The medic riding me was a fella named Derek, and Derek was a pretty cool guy. We talked a little bit about barbecuing and baseball. We're both from Kansas City, and that's a pretty big thing in Kansas City. And I asked him where we're going. He's like, well, I'm taking you to Overland Park Regional. And I get all excited. Overland Park, that's where I live. So I'm thinking, cool, I'm getting a helicopter ride home. And about this time was when my leg started to not necessarily hurt, but it was like a dull ache. Like I pulled a muscle or something. It was just a dull ache, and it was starting to really bug me, so they started to push the pain meds in. And it was a quick flight, maybe a half hour, 40 minutes to the hospital. they wheel me on in. They take me down into emergency, and they start asking all the medical questions and doing vitals and everything and looking over every inch of me. And I'm still thinking I need to call my family. So I'm asking them, like, I can just borrow someone's cell phone. I need to, you know, call my mom and my dad and just let them know that I'm okay, because they're going to hear car accident and automatically assume the worst. That's especially my mother. She's a natural worrywart. If I don't answer my phone in 5 minutes, she thinks I've been kidnapped or something. And, you know, they've got a little bit of pain meds in me now, so I'm just sitting there all hunky-dory, not really hurting, not really feeling great either. Kind of bummed that I'm strapped to a backboard naked, you know, with a gown over me and all sorts of stuff hooked up to me while my family's starting to show up. My mom and dad show up eventually. My mom pretty much broke down when she saw me. I knew that one was coming. And then another one of my aunts arrives, and it was her sister that had passed away earlier in the year. And I remember I looked at her, and the only thing I said to her is, "I'm sorry I scared you, Aunt Kathy." And then she kind of broke down, and that was probably the first time that I had actually cried, because I was happy to see everybody and they were happy that I was okay. My brother, he had showed up and he asked me how I feel. He's like, "How do you feel?" And I said, "Like I've been in a car accident." It's kind of smart ass. I mean, how does it look like I feel? Again, this is kind of where it starts to blur. They start giving me more and more medication as the pain would get worse. I was very thirsty. I was so thirsty. And they didn't know what was wrong with me. They couldn't give me anything to drink or eat, you know, because I might have to have surgery. And I hadn't had anything to drink, you know, since noon when I had a peach knee-high float. And this is probably close to midnight now. So I'm starting to get pretty miserable. And I want to know how everyone's doing. And my father, he's keeping up on this. So he's, he's letting me know, well, Daniel's at this hospital. Okay, good. A few minutes later, he finds out Eddie's at this hospital. All right, that's good. You know, again, it's, we got Neil at this hospital. Okay, good. And I'm, so what about Marcus? And, you know, he's, well, we haven't heard about him yet. Kind of push it back to the side. Go on with what's right in front of me, I guess. And somehow he managed to get a hold of my friend Mary, who had turned around from driving to Minnesota. They were almost there. They heard about the accident and they turned right around. And hearing her voice was, again, one of the greatest things, because here's everyone freaking out around me. And then there's this like angelic, calm voice on the phone of a friend that I've had for many years, you know, kind of joking about some things. And she wants to know what happened. I kind of briefly explain it. It was a pretty short conversation. I don't remember a lot of what was said, but it was meaningful in a brief time, I guess. Eventually we find out that my leg is broken. That's why it didn't work. I broke it right at the top of the femur where it meets my hip. And there was a piece of metal. I'm not sure what it was from or where it came off of. I wish they would have kept it. It would have made for a good souvenir, I guess. There's a piece of metal lodged in the back of my right heel. And then there was some of the x-rays showed a pneumothorax in my chest. I guess it's when some air gets pushed out of your lungs into your chest cavity. So emergency surgery. I've never gone under for surgery, and I'm a little scared. From what I'd been in earlier that day, I guess I probably shouldn't have been all that scared. It's probably the safest thing I'd done all day. I asked them to make sure I get put under. I've heard too many stories about people being awake during surgery. That was, you know, that was my concern at the time, I guess. They push the stuff into my IV, and it's like someone draws a curtain on you. It's just whoosh, and blackness. And then you wake up. I don't know what time it was. It was still dark, and everything hurt from my head to the toe. Everything hurt. My leg hurt very bad, even with, you know, the crazy amount of pain meds they were giving me. I was still filthy, and I probably looked like hell. And coming in and out of the anesthesia, and I'm asking, you know, where is everyone? How is everyone? How's Marcus? Where is everybody at? And my mom and my dad in the room. And my father is a police officer. He's been a police officer for 30 years. And he's had to do stuff like this before. And he tells me where everyone is. And then he says, I'm sorry, but Marcus didn't make it. And here's my dad giving a death notification to his own son, something that I'm sure he never thought he'd have to do. It's something I never thought I'd ever hear. And that was when I broke. I snapped like a twig. There was nothing I could do or say. There's nothing anyone could say to me to make me feel any less horrible than I felt at that one point in time. And then he tells me that Will also didn't make it. And that was just, I was another just punch to the gut. I didn't know him too well. I'd only known him, less than a day, but still that's just two lives taken just like that. And that was one of the worst nights. It was just a constant haze of coming in and out of the medication. And every time I'd wake back up, I'd remember what happened. And it was like, finding out all over again. I just break down again and again and again. And I'm not sure how many times that repeated. I'm sure it was all night. And waking up and it's light outside now. And somehow I've calmed down. I don't know if they gave me something or if I had just gotten it out of my system. And my mom and my dad are still there. And it's obviously still a tough morning. And then friends start to show up. And next thing you know, this hospital room's packed with like 15 people. So tragedy aside, it was great to see everybody there, to support me. And it makes you realize how many people just care deeply about you. So I was in there for about a week and a half. And I was getting around okay on my leg, kind of hobbling with a walker. My foot kept bothering me. I felt like I was constantly stepping on glass. And it was just a little itty-bitty incision, probably no more than 2 inches long on the back of my heel. It kept getting more and more painful. And I'm not sure what the doctor's deal was. I don't know if he didn't want to check his work or he thought I was trying to maybe scam pain medications or something, but he wasn't necessarily believing that I was having all this pain in my foot. Well, the day I was supposed to be discharged to go to my physical therapy, I had a 101 degree fever, and I'm having crazy fever dreams in the middle of the afternoon and hallucinating. And they're like, well, we'll keep him another day until the fever goes down, and then we'll send him on his way. When I kind of come out of the fever haze, one of my favorite nurses, Sarah, she was in the room. And she's going to change my dressing. So she changes the one on my right hip, and then she gets down to the one on my foot. And she kind of pulls her head back a little bit. And I look down, and there's black blood on the bed. And I said, oh, shit, is that from me? And she looks up and says, yep, I'll be right back. So she gets a doctor. And next thing you know, there's two or three other doctors. There's an infectious disease doc in the room, and they're taking cultures of my foot. And I'm going back in for an emergency surgery at 6 o'clock in the afternoon when I was supposed to be getting discharged. So I'm not too worried about this surgery. My foot, is in an incredible amount of pain, but they've got me just pumped to the gills with all sorts of Dilaudid and who knows what else. And they push the anesthesia and put the mask on again. And again, whoosh, world goes dark. This time though, it was a lot different waking up. It was the most intense, incredible pain that I can ever imagine. I can't even fathom anything worse. And it was like stepping on hot nails with the back of my foot over and over again, just driving in. And I had no idea what was going on. Pain to the point where I'm screaming like I'm being murdered. It was bad. And my favorite nurse, Sarah, she's back in the room with me. And this poor girl, she went through so much that night with me, but she was right there with me trying to do everything she could. I guess what happened was somehow there was a mix-up, and I didn't have orders for any sort of pain management or recovery after the surgery. So I went straight from the OR back into my room, you know, basically dry. So wake up, all those nerves start firing again, and it made for a fun night. So I'm not sure how long I was in there, just out of my mind and screaming. I remember, I don't know if I was going into shock or what, but I got cold. I was shivering, and then Sarah's holding my hand, trying to calm me down. They're giving me all the medication they can give me, because there's no doctor that can prescribe me for some reason. It's just the nurses there. And somehow I managed to go to sleep after a few hours, after they got enough of some sort of medication in me. And that was the big medical foul up that happened to me. After that, it was pretty much smooth sailing. The next day, the CFO of the hospital was in my room with a bouquet of flowers, you know, and the please don't sue us speech. But he was he was fairly nice. And you know, I ended up leaving about a week after that. I had to spend about another week and a half in that hospital. And then moving on, I did another 10 days in inpatient rehab and physical therapy at a different hospital in my area where they specialize in stuff like that.
The final outcome for the six people that were in the car, Marcus and Will, as you mentioned, didn't make it.
That's right. So I was right behind Marcus. My right femur was broken right at the femoral neck, I believe it's called, right at the top where it joins your hip bone. The laceration on my foot, which eventually became infected with, I know they cultured it out. There was like four different kinds of bacteria, one of which was flesh eating. So that was kind of interesting. Daniel, who was seated in the middle seat directly to my right, he broke both of his legs and tore most of the tendons and ligaments down there. He was really bad. He ended up getting out of the hospital before I did, but his recovery was a lot longer. He was wheelchair bound for 6 or 8 months, and it was probably 2 years before he was back to what you would call somewhere near 100%. Neil, who was sitting in the back seat behind the passenger on the far right side, he broke his left leg and his right arm. He had ruptured his spleen, and he had some pretty bad face injuries. He didn't break his jaw, but he had a lot of teeth that were knocked out. His lip and his cheek were cut up pretty bad, and he ended up getting quite a few stitches. Eddie, who we found out was ejected from the car, not quite sure how, with all the flips we did when we went into the woods. When I saw him, it looked like there was not a scratch on him. When he got ejected, he must have landed on his head or hit his head, because he had a very bad head injury, very bad concussion. He didn't break his neck. He didn't fracture his skull or anything miraculously. I don't even think he broke a bone in his face. But he was in a coma, medically induced, I believe, for about a week. And then his recovery went fairly smoothly after that. There weren't any cognitive issues. And he has some trouble with the balance every now and again, but he's pretty much his old self for the most part.
And you're pretty much recovered now?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 5 years now, right? Almost.
Yeah, it'll be 5 years in 1 month. And I get a little pain in my leg every now and again. There's nerve damage in my right heel from the infection and the surgeries they had to do, but I'm pretty much back to myself. I mean, last month I biked about 150 miles on the Katy Trail in Missouri, and I'll be honest, I'm feeling better than I've ever felt.
You ever talk about this with some of the other ones that survived?
We discuss it every now and again, right after, in the immediate aftermath, when we talked about it a lot, because I was the only person that didn't either black out due to pain or receive a head injury, so I kind of have the clearest picture of what went down. Obviously, you know, people like Eddie, Neil, and Daniel, they had questions, and I answered them. I would relate the story, but and then you know, when I would come back to work, everyone would want to know what happened, and I guess there is that morbid curiosity where you want to know the story. So I, you know, relate the watered down version to them. But this would be the first time telling the whole story, so to speak.
You can just send them to this podcast now.
Yeah, I can.
And I understand that the agency that handled your rescue was the Warsaw Fire Protection District. So
that's right.
Shout out to those guys, huh?
My hat's off to you, gentlemen.
Is there any part of it that I haven't asked you about that you'd want to mention?
No, there is. It's a little thing that comes to mind. As you can see now, I'm wearing a ball cap. I love wearing ball caps. I've always have. I don't know why. I was wearing one in the accident and obviously got blown off my head when, you know, we're doing all of our flips and everything through the woods. When the trooper was looking around the car, he comes out and he says, "Who was wearing a hat?" Like, that's kind of a weird question. I said, "That'd be me." He just goes, "It's your lucky day." And he throws my hat back to me. So this would be the hat that I was wearing at the time. Seen better days, as you can see, but there's the black you see there is engine oil from the car. It looked a lot worse that day. It's since been washed, but
maybe you could send me a picture of that hat and we'll post that on the website.
I'll send you a picture of the hat and my can of knee-high here from the accident.
I'm glad you made it through. I'm really sorry about your friends, but I appreciate you sharing the story with us today.
Well, appreciate you giving me an opportunity to tell my story. I mean, what I want people to take out of this is, number one, wear your seatbelt, obviously. I doubt that I would be here were it not for my seatbelt. And number two, don't drive recklessly. What happened could have easily been avoided. And the only reason it happened is because of stupidity and recklessness. It shouldn't have happened, but it did. And unfortunately, we have to live with those consequences now.
Thank you for listening to this episode. As you might imagine, it was not easy for Luke to talk about the day his best friend died. Every time I release a new show, I want to introduce you to people and stories you just won't find on other podcasts. Lots of stuff going on here, and I wanted to let you know so you're aware of what's happening. First up, the Patreon rewards are now in place. I was kind of surprised the other day because someone asked me about what it costs to be a supporter of the show, and she said she thought it had to be a big dollar amount, but that is definitely not the case. You can be a supporter of the show for as little as $1 a month. The support levels are $1, $3, $5, $10, and $20, and you can get What Was That Like stickers. You can get your name listed on the website as a supporter. You can even get a shout out right here on the show. All of that information is on my Patreon, which is at whatwasthatlike.com/support. And for those of you who use Reddit, and I just love Reddit, by the way, the What Was That Like podcast now has its own subreddit. It's still kind of a work in progress, and there's only a few people there right now because it's new, but I'll be adding features and posting stuff in there. And Reddit is a great place to hang out with other listeners and myself, of course. I'll be there. So I hope to see you in there. The group is at reddit.com/r/whatwasthatlike. And as a reminder, we also have a private Facebook group. If you'd like to join the discussion there, that's at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. I have to tell you, I'm pretty excited about this podcast. It's just now a year old, 27 episodes out, and it's growing faster than I expected it to. I have some great interviews lined up too. And wait till you hear the next one, episode 28, coming out on July 19. It's going to blow you away. I have no doubt that this show is going to be one of the most popular podcasts in the not too distant future, because every time someone hears it for the first time, they tell me how much they love it. Then they go and download all the past episodes. And for that to keep happening, I'm counting on you. Yeah, I'm just talking to you right now. I'm counting on you to tell your friends and family and everyone else about it. Most people find out about new shows by word of mouth. So thanks for spreading the word. And I'll see you on the next episode, where we'll once again ask the question, what was that like?